Please find Jeremiah chapter 50. We'll begin in just a moment in that place. There is one thing that I do want to alert you to. We are in the process of transitioning from one pastor to, hopefully not too long from now, a new pastor. And there is, sort of running alongside of that effort, we have a governance team. They've actually been in existence in one form or another for 3 years or more, maybe 4 years. They are close to being ready to bring a report and a recommendation to the church to try to clarify some matters of church governance before we get to the point of calling a new pastor. This is a necessary step to take. They have asked to have some time to do town halls prior to bringing this report. And one of the things they want to do is, even before the town hall, want to go to a couple of critical Sunday school classes. So next Sunday, both hours, representatives of the governance team will be in to bring a report on what they're working on and what they think their recommendations are going to be, to get your feedback, to get your reactions, to get your counsel, to get your criticisms or your encouragement or some of both. If you want to see the PowerPoint presentation that they're going to bring next Sunday morning, it's already online. If you take a look at the class's website, it's there. You can look at it this week if you choose to. In addition, one of the members in the first hour had been visiting her family back in Ohio and heard a powerful sermon out of Timothy from a church that she attended up there, and felt like that spoke very much to the question of how the pastor relates to a church. The governance study is more how the church relates to itself and to the pastor. And so she is trying to get a link to that particular thing. I'll also put that online if I can get it. So just be watching for those two things. So if you found Jeremiah 50, we can begin. Last week we covered 12 or 13 chapters, which is close to a record for us. My plan is to set another record today. You'll see what I mean by that as we move a little further ahead. Several of those chapters were specific prophecies that Jeremiah had against or about neighboring countries. And we stopped at chapter 50, part because we were running out of time, and part because there's two chapters, chapter 50 and 51, devoted to the prophecies against Babylon. And so that's what we want to look at today. As we begin, I want you to turn to Jeremiah 52. And you'll notice that Jeremiah 52 is a narrative report of the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of Jerusalem. That is parallel to what we've already looked at in 2 Kings 24 and 25. So when we get through 50 and 51, we've essentially finished the book of Jeremiah, because this is material we've already seen. It talks about the destruction of Jerusalem, and we've been through that before. So our focus today is on chapter 50 and 51. As we start that, I'd like you to look at the tail end of chapter 51. And especially I'd like you to look starting at verse 59. If you look at verse 59, it says, "This is the order that the prophet Jeremiah gave to." The person's name ends with the same set of letters that the word Isaiah ends. So presumably you would pronounce this as Sariah, or perhaps Sariah. And it names his dad, it names some other things about him. It says that he was part of the exile group. And it says his former position with the king had been what?
Quartermaster.
Yours says quartermaster. Mine says Lord Chamberlain, which was an officer who was sort of in charge of the management of affairs for the palace. Pretty important person. Verse 60, on one sheet, Jeremiah had written down the entire disaster that was to befall Babylon. That is, just in case you didn't figure it out, all of these words recorded here against Babylon. What's that? That's chapter 50, chapter 51, up through verse 48. He had it all written on one page. Have you guys dealt with reports to upper management? Have you had the experience of doing this? If you can't put it all on one page, don't bother, because the poor things can't seem to read any further than one page. Have you seen this sort of thing? So he puts it all on one page. He gives it to this guy. Presumably the guy is somehow hiding it away, and it's not real clear where. Isaiah himself, we're going to come to his prophecies at some point, he talked about how when people were carried away into exile, they actually went barefoot and naked. So where would this guy have hidden this piece of paper? I don't know. And I'm not suggesting anything ugly by that. I'm just saying there's a challenge somehow doing this. Maybe they had some scraps of clothes, but somehow he got this piece of paper. It says, Jeremiah said to Sariah, or Sariah, when you reach Babylon, see to it that you read all of these words aloud. To whom? I think it's implied pretty clearly. To whom? To the people who were in exile. There were two or three or four waves of exiles. This was the last of those. So there would have been people already in exile. Here comes the last group. When you get there, read it to them. And then what? Say, you, Lord, have promised to destroy this place so that no one will live here ever again, neither human nor animal, and it will be desolate forever. Now, this is the same place that Jeremiah said, you've got a choice. And the choice is no longer freedom or slavery. The choice is what?
Live or die.
And the only way to live is what? Surrender to Babylon and go into exile. And you're supposed to pray for the peace of Babylon. Pray for the... Work for its welfare, right? But Jeremiah is now saying, and it's not inconsistent. He's now saying, but God says the time is going to come. After the 70 years, after you come back from exile, Babylon's going to be destroyed. Nobody's going to live there anymore. I am told, I've seen some reports on this, that up into the 1700s, people did not believe either Assyria or Babylon ever really existed, because nobody could find any trace of those. Archaeology in the late 1800s and into the 1900s has begun to find it, but you don't see it. You have to dig down into the sand of the desert to find these places. They're there, and they're huge, and they're enormous, but nobody saw them. They had completely disappeared. The prophecy that he's giving was true. And after you've said that, verse 63, then when you have finished reading this sheet, tie it to a stone and throw it into the middle of the Euphrates River. The stone is probably still there. Nobody knows which stone it is. Maybe the sheet of paper is still there. He may have made it out of Tyvek or something cool like that. Okay? So we're looking at something that basically he says, put it on the stone and throw it into the Euphrates. Now look at the last sentence. In the same way this stone sinks, never to be seen again, in the same way Babylon is going to sink. They keep talking about Babylon covered by the ocean. But if you've ever looked at desert dunes, it kind of looks like waves frozen in time. Something like that. It's all covered, and that seems to have come true. So, okay so far? Good. Chapter 50, verse 2. Announce it to the nations, proclaim it, hoist a signal and proclaim it. Make no secret of it. Say, Babylon is destroyed. Bel is disgraced, Marduk is shattered. Who are Bel and Marduk? These are the principal idols, including one probably that had child sacrifice associated with it. Verse 3, a nation is marching on her from the north to turn her country into a desert. No one will live there anymore. Human and animal have fled and gone. Now, look at verse 4. All of a sudden, the tone shifts dramatically. Verse 4, verse 5, verse 6, what do they talk about? Israel and Judah, they're coming back. Babylon, destroyed, we'll never see them again. Look at verse 5. They will ask the way to Zion, and then turn their faces towards her. What does that mean? They'll ask their way. They'll have been gone long enough that most of the people who are coming back will never have been there. Yeah. Verse 6, lost sheep, such were my people. Their shepherds had led them astray, even the mountains misled them. Remember, the mountains were the high spots where they would put their worship centers for false gods. From mountain to hill they went, forgetful of their fold. What does it say in verse 8? First few words, quickly.
Flee,
your says. What does somebody else say?
Wander.
Wander, that's not strong enough.
Wander away.
Wander away is not strong enough. Escape is what mine says. Flee is what yours says. Get out of there.
Get up and go.
Get up and go, yeah. Get up and go.
It says wander and then it says go forth.
Yeah. Flee from where? Escape from where?
Babylon.
Babylon. Turn to chapter 51, verse 6. What does it say? Run for your lives. What does it say in 51:45? Get out of her, my people. Save your lives, each one of you. Now, this is early. This is going to hit 70 plus years ahead. Right? This is going to hit 70 plus years ahead. And Jeremiah is already saying there's going to be a call for people to come out. How many Christians died in the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans? Tradition has an answer to that. Do you know what the answer is?
What was your question?
How many Christians died during the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans?
None.
Zero. Why?
They left.
Why did they leave? Because God told them to get out.
Great condition.
God told them to get out. Go. And as you're going, do all these things, but go. Get out. There was something of what Paul said to the Ephesians recorded in Acts. There's something about what God had said that isn't recorded in things, but tradition says that the Christians got out and that there were no Christians left during that destruction time. Something like that appears to have happened in Babylon. This remnant that comes back, they're going to be coming back fleeing from something that's going to be destroyed shortly after they leave. Okay?
So when we're talking about in the future, from this point, that's when the Persians would have come in. Is that right?
Yeah, we're going to find out in these two chapters, we don't get to call them the Persians. We get to call them the Medes. And as long as you've raised that question, let me see. Turn to chapter 51, verse 11. We'll do this out of order. Middle of the verse, what does it say? 51:11. The Lord has roused the spirit of?
King of the Medes.
King of the Medes. Verse 28 in chapter 51. King of the Medes. So we don't get to say the Persians out of this part, but we're going to see Medes and Persians will be the group that they talk about. Okay, back to chapter 50. Look at verse 29. The first part of the verse doesn't catch your eye, but the middle part should. Go to the middle of the verse. Do you see anything interesting there? Verse 29 of chapter 50. Verse 29 of chapter 50. First part says, leave her no way of escape. But right after that it says, repay her
according to the deed, her deeds.
As her deeds deserve. Look at the next line. Do unto her as she has done unto others. Anybody hear an inverse echo of something? No. Matthew 7:12. What's this? It's an inverse statement of what? Of the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. What's it saying here? Do unto her as she's been doing unto others. Fascinating little moment there.
The key to it, though, seems that for she has defied the Lord.
Mine says was arrogant to the Lord, to the Holy One of Israel. God was using Babylon as a tool. And Babylon, with some exception with Nebuchadnezzar, as recorded in Daniel, with some exception, didn't realize it. Acted as if, well, this is just all our due. We can do what we want. And God said, your arrogance is going to, you know, you've done what I've asked, but your attitude as you did it is going to bring your own destruction. Do unto her as she has done to others, as she has treated others.
This probably doesn't really fit here, but I was listening to one of the news programs on TV, and one of either the, I think it was a Hamas official, or somebody taking that side said, look, we're just doing almost nothing to Israel. It should be an eye for, I mean, you know, what we've done, they can do back to us, but they were complaining about being the destruction that was occurring to the Palestinians, and the Hebrews were really over it. That's okay. But it does lead to that scripture.
If you're seeing parallels, not just for Gaza, not just for Syria and Iraq, but certainly for those. There's echoes all through here. Take a look at verse 40 of chapter 50. The destruction of Babylon is going to be like where are Sodom and Gomorrah? Nobody's ever found them. Some theories say they're at the bottom of the Dead Sea. No one will live there anymore. No human being will settle there anymore. Verse 45, especially verse 46. Look at verse 46, still in chapter 50. The earth quakes at the sound of Babylon's capture, and the shouting echoes through the nations. Everybody's going to know who's anywhere nearby. Everybody's going to know when Babylon falls. Now, we've seen this thing about the Medes. Let's do something else before we go back to the Medes. Let's look at chapter 51, verse 7. Chapter 51, verse 7. I find this a fascinating verse. It's worded in a very interesting way. Chapter 51, verse 7. What does it say? Babylon was a golden cup in the Lord's hand. She, who's that? Babylon, made the whole world drunk. The nations drank her wine and then went mad. Babylon is suddenly fallen. Babylon is broken. Wail for her. We tried to cure Babylon. She got no better. Leave her alone. Let's go. Ever heard anything like that before?
Yes.
Where?
Jerusalem is a cup.
Yeah.
Trembling in the nations.
Yeah, the perfect parallel is in Revelation. We're going to go there in a little while. The whole world is drunk on the wine of Babylon. And Revelation says, especially Revelation 18, we're going to get there soon, Babylon has fallen. Babylon has fallen. No, we're going to get there today. We're going to get there today. We're going to get there today. But this picture, drunk on wine.
Your whole attitude has changed.
Think back to the Civil War. There was a song out of the Civil War. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. Same picture. But where is this golden cup? It's in God's hands. Babylon is a tool for the Lord's purposes. And when they finish, their attitude is going to condemn them to the same punishment or worse. We said the Medes were going to take over. That almost requires that I pause, which I now will, and go to Daniel. Would you like to join me there? Look at Daniel chapter 5, and I just want to quickly go through some of this. How long did it take for Babylon's destruction? All happened in a day, just very quickly. And the words of these two chapters talk about that. So here we are, chapter 5 of Daniel. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for his noblemen, 1,000 of them. And in the presence of this 1,000, he drank his wine. Having tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave orders for the gold and silver vessels to be brought, which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the sanctuary in Jerusalem, so that the king, his noblemen, his wives, and, my translation says this euphemistically, the women who sang for him, could drink out of them. The gold and silver vessels taken from the sanctuary of the temple of God of Jerusalem were brought in, and the king, his noblemen, his wives, and the women who sang for him drank out of them. They drank their wine and praised their idols of gold and silver, of bronze and iron, of wood and stone. And suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and began to write on the plaster of the palace wall directly behind the lampstand. And the king could see the hand as it wrote. The king turned pale with alarm, his hip joints went slack, and his knees began to knock. What does the king do immediately? He calls for his astrologers, for his soothsayers. I'm going to try to say that very slowly each time I say it. And he challenged them, tell me what it means, the things this hand has written. And they couldn't do it. And about that time, the queen, I'm now down to verse 10, I think it is, attracted by the noise, came in and said, King, there's a man named Daniel who during your father's reign proved himself to be full of the Spirit of God. He can help you with this. He brought Daniel in, promised him riches, promised him power and fame, if he would just explain to him what it meant. And Daniel said, keep your trinkets. I don't need them, but I will tell you what it means. He then begins to talk about what happened with Nebuchadnezzar, how he got blown up with arrogance and pride, and how God took him down. And he says, verse 22, you Belshazzar, who are his son, you have not humbled your heart in spite of knowing all of this. You've defied the Lord of heaven. You've had the vessels of his temple brought to you, and you, your noblemen, your wives, and the women singing for you have drunk your wine out of them. You've praised gods of gold and silver, of bronze and iron, of wood and stone, which can neither see, nor hear, nor understand. But you've given no glory to the God in whose hands your breath itself and all of your fortunes lie. That's why he has sent the hand which has written these words. The hand has written many, many tekel parson. And the meaning of the words is this. Many? What does it mean? He has measured your sovereignty and put an end to it. Tekel. You've been weighed in the balance, mine says, and found wanting. Parson, your kingdom has been divided between the Medes we already knew about and the Persians, which we hadn't. Belshazzar gave Daniel all the trinkets, and that same night he was murdered, and Darius the Mede took the kingdom at the age of 62. And a few years later, Cyrus came in and sent the Jews back home. Babylon was a golden cup in the hands of the Lord. She made the whole world drunk, nations drank her wine, and then they went mad. There is a double meaning to this. The meaning is here, and the meaning also extends over into Revelation. Chapter 51. If you take a look at verse 15, you're in the middle of a praise hymn to the Lord. In the middle of all of this, Jeremiah stops and gives a praise hymn to the Lord. By his power he made the earth. By his wisdom he set the world firm. By his discernment he spread out the heavens. When he thunders, there's roaring of water in the heavens. He raises clouds from the furthest limit of the earth. He makes his lightning flash for the downpour and bring wind from his storehouse. And at this everyone stands stupefied, uncomprehending. Every goldsmith blushes for his idols. And it goes on, and the powerful phrase that I think is found in New Living and in King James says something like this. Idols are worthless, that's verse 18. Verse 19, but God is no idol. Mine has somewhat different words, but those are the words in one translation. Chapter 51, verse 43. Her towns have been turned into wasteland, her parched land, a desert. Verse 42, the sea has risen over Babylon, she sinks beneath its boisterous waves. End of verse 43, a country where no one lives and where no one goes. Look at verse 57. Very interesting. Parallel to Daniel 5 as well as parallel to Revelation 18. What does it say? I'll make her princes and her sages drunk. Her governors, her magistrates, her warriors will fall into an everlasting sleep, never to wake again. I'm going to stop here and jump over to Revelation 18 because I think you need to see this too. I saw an angel come down from heaven with great authority given to him. At the top of his voice he shouted, Babylon has fallen, Babylon the Great has fallen, and has become the haunt of devils and a lodging for every foul spirit and loathsome bird. All the nations have drunk deep of the wine of her prostitution. Every king on the earth has prostituted himself with her. Every merchant has grown rich through her debauchery. Verse 4, another voice spoke from heaven, and I heard it say, what did it say? Come out from her, come out my people. Do you see the parallels for what you're seeing in Jeremiah? I think that's specific. Verse 8, in one day the plagues will fall on her, disease and mourning and famine. She'll be burned to the ground. The Lord who condemned her is mighty. There's more in there. We've talked about that on other days. I won't take you any further into it now. But the parallels are powerful. In one day, we saw in Daniel 5 how that day came. Okay. You come to chapter 52. It parallels 2 Kings, chapters 24 and 25. It tells the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar's army. There's a little tag at the end of this that you may not have noticed. Verse 31 through 34, the last four verses of the book. It tells you one thing that's fascinating. Zedekiah, all of his sons had been killed before him and in his eyes put out before he was taken off into exile. But what does it say in these four verses? There's an earlier king who is in one of the earlier waves of exiles. Jehoiachin, it calls him in our translation. And what does it say? He was taken out of prison. Not just set free. Where does he go? He goes to eat at the king's table and receives the king's blessings. Why is that here? That's letting you know that there is a lineage of the kings, the descendants of David. There's a lineage that continues into the exile period. And it's from that lineage that Jesus is going to come.
It's on the modern Christmas day. 25th of the
12th. Does it say that?
25th day of the
12th. I didn't see that in my... Well, it would be the last month then of the old calendar. I don't know. I didn't spot that. I've just turned the page. What's the next chapter after Jeremiah 52? Lamentations 1. And you were supposed to read Lamentations as well, right? You may not have known that because you were away. Okay? Okay, here's my challenge to you. How many chapters in Lamentations?
Five
chapters. How many verses in the first chapter? 22. How many in the last chapter? Chapter 5. 22. How many in the second chapter? 22. How many in the fourth chapter? 22. How many in the third chapter? Take a guess. 66. What's 66?
Three times
22. There seems to be some significance of 22. What's that significance? If you have a Bible that has the same functioning as mine, you may know. But the rest of you won't.
It's the
have you seen a book? From Barnes & Noble, maybe. Where at the first of each chapter, the very first letter of the very first word is capitalized and made big. Have you ever seen that?
Mm-hmm.
And then, thanks, Paul.
Okay.
Children's picture books will have that, right? BookNet might have had that. These are alphabetical chapters. There are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. Mine has off to the left of verse 1 of chapter 1, Aleph. Off next to verse 2, Bet. Next, verse 3, Gimel. Those are the first three letters, like our ABC for the English language. 22 letters, 22 verses. So what happens in chapter 3? You get three verses for each letter. Otherwise, it's there. Now, I've had it criticized this morning already, and I accept the criticism. When you get to chapter 5, it isn't set out poetically. In mind, the Aleph and so forth are not there. But it still has 22 verses, so I think the pattern is maintained. Everybody okay? Now, before we look at Lamentations, I want to take you to Psalm 137. So I'm going to hold my place in Lamentations. I'm going to go to Psalm 137. And I want to read this with you. By the rivers of Babylon, what did we do? We sat down and wept at the memory of Zion. On the poplars there we had hung our harps. For our jailers had asked us to sing them a song. Our captors wanted to make merry. Sing us one of the songs of Zion, they said. How could we sing a song of the Lord on alien soil. If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand wither. May my tongue remain stuck to the roof of my mouth if I do not keep you in mind, if I do not count Jerusalem the greatest of my joys. The last two verses get ugly and then uglier as they call down imprecations against those who have done this to them. But look at those first four. Look how it ended. May my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I don't keep you in mind, if I don't count Jerusalem the greatest of my joys. I want to take you to Psalm 87, because Psalm 87 expresses the joy of Jerusalem in a way that I have never seen it expressed before. And I would have missed this. I would have missed this if I hadn't looked at it in the message. So, Sydney, you've got this in the message probably. Follow along with me. I'm going to emphasize it when I get to it, and I think it's going to surprise you. He founded Zion on the holy mountain, and oh, how God loves his home. Loves it far better than all the homes of Jacob put together. God's hometown, oh, everybody there talks about you. I name them off, those among whom I'm famous. Egypt and Babylon, also Philistia, even Tyre, along with Cush. Words getting around, they point them out. This one was born again here. Did you hear the wording that the message gave for that? This one was born again here. The words getting out on Zion, men and women, right and left, are getting born again in her. God registers their names in his book. This one, this one, and this one. Born again, right here. Singers and dancers, give credit to Zion. All my springs are in you. We do not look forward to physical Zion. We look forward to the New Jerusalem. And some of that New Jerusalem is already here. I've never seen this part of Psalms written in the message. People are getting born again right here. And it's fitting them, readying them for the New Jerusalem. This one, and this one, and this one. Names being written down in God's books. I don't know for sure. I don't know how well the people in Babylon, in exile, would have understood this. But this is the joy of Jerusalem that they should be remembering. This is what they should capture. When they came back, idolatry was never again an issue. That was gone. Let's take a quick look at Lamentations. We've got about 9 minutes. Let's see how we go. Stick with me. Verse 12, chapter 1. All you who pass this way, look and see. Is there any sorrow like the sorrow inflicted on me with which the Lord struck me on the day of his burning anger? Verse 18. The Lord is in the right, for I rebelled against his command. Listen, all you people, see my sorrow. My young girls and my young men have gone into captivity. Chapter 2, verse 6. He wrecked his domain like a garden. He destroyed the assembly points. The Lord erased the memory of festivals and Sabbaths in Zion. In the heat of his anger, he treated king and priest with contempt. The Lord rejected his altar. He has come to loathe his sanctuary, and has given her palace walls into the clutches of the enemy. From the uproar they made in the Lord's temple, it might have been a festival day. Verse 13. To what can I compare or liken you, daughter of Jerusalem? Who can rescue you and comfort you, young daughter of Zion? Huge as the sea is your ruin. Who can heal you? Verse 17. The Lord has done what he planned. He carried out his threat as he ordained long ago. He has destroyed without pity, increasing the might of your foes, letting your foes get the credit. Chapter 3, verse 16. He has broken my teeth with gravel, and he has fed me on ashes. I've been deprived of peace. I've forgotten what happiness is, and I thought my lasting hope in the Lord is lost. verse 22. Surely the Lord's mercies are not over. Surely his deeds of faithful love are not exhausted. Every morning they are renewed. Great is his faithfulness. And now verse 24, which I think is the most powerful verse in this whole chapter. The Lord is all I have, I said to myself, so I'll put my hope in him. There's a woman, a young woman, who wrote a song and sang it. It was on the Christian song charts a few years ago. And the chorus said, when you come to the point where he's all you have, you find he's all you need. That's the same thing that's being said right here. Verse 25, the Lord is good to those who trust him, to all who search for him. It is good to wait in silence for the Lord to save. It is good for someone to bear the yoke from a young age. Chapter 3, verse 31, for the Lord will not reject anyone forever. If he brings grief, he will have pity out of the fullness of his faithful love. Verse 34, when all the prisoners in a country are crushed underfoot. Think about the headlines from this week. When all the prisoners in a country are crushed underfoot, when human rights are overridden in defiance of the Most High, when someone is cheated of justice, does the Lord not see it? Verse 40, let us examine our path. Let us ponder it and return to the Lord. Let us raise our hearts and hands to God in heaven. We are the ones who have sinned and rebelled, and you have not forgiven. Chapter 3, verse 55. Lord, I called on your name from the deep pit. You heard my voice. Don't close your ear to my prayer, to my cry. You're near when I call to you. You said, do not be afraid. Lord, you defended my cause. You redeemed my life. Chapter 5, verse 14. I'm going to back up to verse 11 because I think you see the power of this even better when I do that. The women in Zion have been raped, the young girls in the towns of Judah. Princes have been hanged by their hands. The face of the old won no respect. Youths have been put to the mill. Boys stagger under the load of wood. Elders have deserted the gateway. The young have given up their music. Verse 15, joy has vanished from our hearts. Our dancing has turned to mourning. The crown has fallen from our heads. Alas that we ever sinned. That's why our heart is sick. Our hearts are sick. That's why our eyes are dimmed. Because Mount Zion is desolate. Jackals roam to and fro on it. And yet, you, Lord, rule from eternity. Your throne endures from age to age. Why do you never remember us? Why do you abandon us so long? Make us come back to you, Lord, and we will come back. Restore us as we were before. That's the book of Lamentations. God gave Israel and Judah a hope, a slim one, but a hope. Babylon, no hope at all. And the echoes of the fall of Babylon come all the way through the Bible and come out into the future that we still have not experienced. But so has that hope in the middle of hardship. We have brothers and sisters in places in this world right now who are tough. Gaza, northern Iraq, and Syria are probably the most obvious places. But there's other places too. And we don't have any idea what they're suffering. But words of this chapter and chapters like this are spoken for them. And our day could come. I don't know what we're going to do next. Next week we're going to have a guest in to talk about governance. I told you that. Sometime next week I'll tell you what we're going to try to do next. But I'm not going to make that decision right now. I hope you have a good week. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we've looked at hard sections of Scripture. And we realize some of what we read we may be facing, but we sure realize there's people who are your children. People who are committed to your Son. Who are right now facing the things that these chapters seem to talk about. So today we stop to pray for them. Give them a sense of your presence. Give them a sense of hope where there is no hope. Possibility where there seems to be no way out. And give us the sense and guidance so that when our turn comes to have an opportunity to speak, we can speak. And speak rightly and speak effectively. When it comes our turn to do, that we will know it and that we will be able to do and do rightly. Give us your eyes. Give us your heart. Let us be your hands. For we ask it all in your Son's name. Amen.